This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Louis Armstrong began making music as a boy in church with his mother, but also he made music in the streets of his birthplace, New Orleans. In New Orleans, music was everywhere. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at Armstrong's formative years in New Orleans. Our guest is Thomas Brothers, author of Louis Armstrong's New Orleans. Brothers says the book in part is about Armstrong's experience of a complex city. He says Armstrong was shaped by his total immersion in the life of the city, the music of the city. Brothers says, quoting here, "The city and the musician were both extraordinary, their relationship unique, their impact on American culture incalculable. Excuse me. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Thomas Brothers is a professor of music at Duke University. In addition to Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, he is also the author of Louis Armstrong in His Own Words. The book, Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, now available in paperback from W.W. Norton. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Thomas Brothers, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Celeste.
What was New Orleans like at the time of Louis Armstrong's birth in 1901?
There were many sides of New Orleans in 1901, as you can imagine. And the place where he was born was a little bit remote in the city. It was at his grandmother's house. And it was a place where there had been, a vast migration of people from the former slave plantations of Louisiana and Mississippi, the large plantations of the Mississippi River Corridor, the huge sugar plantations, the cotton plantations. And people from those places had been migrating to the city for the past two decades after the collapse of Reconstruction, among them his mother, who left when she was 15 years old from a plantation about 70 miles west of New Orleans. And those people were settling in the city, some 40,000 of them during that period. So that is the main social context in which Armstrong grew up. But as I say, New Orleans was a complicated place, and there are many other kinds of social contexts going on there, too.
Yeah. All these people coming together in the city, finding common ground in a number of places, you say, in churches, in street parades, funerals. Let's talk about the street parade. What was its purpose?
Parades. New Orleanians love parades, and they still do today. As you know, Mardi Gras is the most famous of the parades. But back when Armstrong was young, there were parades almost every day of the year. A really important part of the society Armstrong grew up in were the so-called fraternal societies, which sponsored these parades. And every society, these are little clubs. Sometimes they're unions. Sometimes they're just local block clubs. Sometimes they're nationally organized clubs like the Masons or the Odd Fellows. And these clubs sponsored parades to sort of, that was sort of their focal point, gathering around this event. And that was how they made their presence known and tried to make a big splash. So there were parades constantly, and Armstrong wandered around behind them almost constantly during his childhood. He talks about this a lot in his writings. So that was one purpose of parades. The other famous example of parades in New Orleans is the so-called funeral with music, or the jazz funeral, as most people know it. During Armstrong's life in New Orleans, it was called the funeral with music, which meant, of course, as most people are a little bit aware of, there was music accompanying the funeral procession from the church to the cemetery, and then after the cemetery, there was a recessional from the funeral back into the to the home of the deceased, where a party would be given. On the way to the funeral, the music was very slow and mournful, and there was a whole selection of hymns that were played, and the people who gathered along behind the casket as it was carried there by a horse-drawn carriage would sing along with the hymns. And then at the moment of release, as they say, the body was released, meaning that the soul was released from the body, at the burial, the band would make a about-face turn and leave the cemetery playing upbeat jazz. And this would be the call to a lot more people. The attendance would at this point spike in numbers. And a lot more people would gather around to really participate in this party, a celebration of ongoing life, you could say. And that would process back into the center of town or wherever the deceased lived. So this was all these funerals, by the way, were sponsored by these fraternal societies that I mentioned. And they were only for men, by the way. Women did not have funerals with music. It's an interesting discovery that that I was surprised to find out. But it's because all these this institution of the funeral with music was sponsored by these fraternal clubs. So that's another part of the daily texture of parade life in New Orleans.
Yeah. What were the roots of the parade? I mean, to have these parades, so many parades. What was it?
Well, it's a warm place, and a lot of people like to be outside. There's no air conditioning, and it's good to be outside. I guess a lot of it has to do with French military culture. A lot of the parade traditions reference French military culture, the kind of instrumentation that's used, and so forth. Certainly, parades were common among a white society, not just black society, but white society too. So it was a real New Orleans institution. I mean, back then, late 19th century, parades were more common throughout the United States as well. I mean, there was a big outdoor band culture in a lot of towns in the United States. It wasn't just New Orleans, but New Orleans, it was really very special and a tremendous amount of music.
And as I understand it from reading the book, that also the parade was a way to move from one place to another.
Yeah, that's right. Armstrong himself wrote a lot about his life, and you really have the sense that he's getting it down for posterity, for people to understand, his point of view on his life. He realized that was important. He wanted that to be known. And I've worked a lot with his writings. As you mentioned, the mm-hmm. earlier book I had put together, Louis Armstrong in His Own Words. So I've spent a lot of time with his writings. And there was one passage in particular that puzzled me a little bit. And he talks about this. He's writing in 1955 when he's really one of the most famous musicians in the world. And he says this one moment in 1921, he's born in 1901, by the way, and leaves the city in 1922. So we're just about the end of his time in New Orleans. He's 20 years old. And he says, this one parade I marched in with the Tuxedo Brass Band, they hired me just for this special occasion. He said, that was like the most important moment of my life. I just felt like I had become somebody at that moment. And so I really spent a lot of time thinking about why that moment would have been so important to him. And I came up with a number of reasons. One was, and he talks about this, and other people talk about this, one was that a movement for African Americans in New Orleans in 1921 was restricted. You couldn't just wander around into any part of town that you felt like going to. And that was not unique to New Orleans. That was true throughout the United States. I mean, you had to, if you were an African American in 1921, you had to watch where you were and who knew you and so forth. If you wandered into an area where you weren't known, you could get in trouble. So I think that's part of what's going on here, is that in a parade, he could really see the whole city. And he grew up doing that, by the way. He grew up attending to musicians. He found a way that if he offered to carry their horn when they weren't playing, during the stretches when they weren't playing, he could actually attach himself to the parade and become an official member. Otherwise, he'd be turned back at certain boundaries police were pretty strict about that. You couldn't, if you were a child, you could follow parades, but only so far into boundaries of neighborhoods that, where you didn't belong. You had to go back. So, yes, to answer your question, the freedom of movement is definitely a part of what's going on in these parades. Another part is that these parades are really broadcasting vernacular culture, African-American vernacular culture throughout the city. And I think that's an important dimension, too, of this parade life. Here you have a period of our nation's history which is horrible for racial oppression. The first two decades of the 20th century are often referred to as the absolute nadir of race relations. This is the period when Jim Crow laws are being put into place one after the other. And this is the period when lynchings are peaking throughout the South, and dramatic rise in lynchings. And there are all kinds of other intimidations and threats of violence that are going on. The Ku Klux Klan is very strong. So there's a lot going on here. The early years of jazz, the birth of jazz, coincides with this period of tremendous oppression.
Yeah. Among the reasons that it was important to Louis Armstrong that he marched with the Tuxedo Brass Band, you say, is that he achieved friendship and respect from the old school Creoles, perhaps for the first time.
Yes, that's another part of what makes New Orleans special, another part of the social landscape in the first decades of the 20th century, are the so-called Creoles of color, who were people of mixed ancestry, African and European, often French. And at the end of the Civil War, let's say that it would be 1860 was the last census that had a category in it for the ancestors of these people, the gens de couleur libre, the free people of color. These people had a mixed ancestry, but they had a intermediate position in the caste system of New Orleans. This is sort of something that makes it special in the United States, is this three-tiered caste system: whites, slaves, and the free people of color. And as you can imagine, when somebody holds an intermediate position in a social system like this, they do everything they can to associate themselves with the more powerful side of the social spectrum and everything they can to distance themselves from the people who are classed inferior to them. And that was a very strong part of who these Creoles were. It wasn't totally a monolithic situation, and it was more nuanced and complicated than that in the history of these people. But that's a primary feature of life for these Creoles of color. By the time Armstrong is born in 1901, and with, as I mentioned, the birth of Jim Crow laws and so forth, these people were trying to hold on desperately to this middle position. The old caste system, the legal caste system, was gone, but now we had a new caste system, essentially with a kind of apartheid and Jim Crow laws. And the Creoles of color, as you probably know, were classified not as middle but as black, as colored. So they sat on the same side of the movable screen and trolley cars that the former slaves sat on, and they were put in the same schools that the former slaves were put in, and so forth. So it was a very stressful time for them because they were dropping down in the social hierarchy, and this created a lot of tension between the two groups. So for Armstrong to make his way into those musical circles, the other side of their history that I should mention is that they had tremendous musical accomplishment, a tremendous tradition of musical accomplishment in a very what I call Eurocentric way. They many of them had access to very high-level training on their instruments. Some of them had access directly to Paris Conservatoire, where they went to get trained, and they were just known nationally, actually, for very high level of musical skill on brass instruments especially, but also violin and other instruments, piano, and so forth. And so their presence in New Orleans was very strong, especially in the parade tradition that we talked about. When Armstrong was hearing parades, the flashiest players, the most polished players, the players who knew their way around the instruments the best and who could do the most dazzling things, things, and who had the most perfection in ensemble rehearsal and so forth. All this, according to Eurocentric tradition, as I say, these people were all Creoles of color. I mean, the whites were an acknowledgement of this also. This was a very special thing for them. So it's a part of the dynamic, social dynamic of New Orleans, part of the musical dynamic that Armstrong grew up with, is the presence of these people and their accomplishment, their history, and what their aims were.
And from these Creole musicians, what did Armstrong learn? And from the other musicians, the Negro musicians, what did he learn?
I guess if I were to say the main theme of my book would be what he is learning from the Negro musicians, and we have to use that word, that's the word of the period, because the social classifications are so complicated that it gets confusing if we start talking about African Americans. Do they include the Creoles and so forth? And so, yes, the Negro musicians with whom he grew up, you mentioned the church, which is an extremely important part of his musical upbringing. Blues, another extremely important part. Those two are really the foundation of his music in the first 10, 15 years of his life. That's how he was trained to think in those terms of what's going on in church and what we imagine was going on in the churches he went to with his mother when he was a child are the ecstatic traditions of religious worship, the demonstrative, emotionally overt traditions of a lot of movement in church, a lot of so-called shouting, as they say, a lot of percussion instruments, a lot of group participation, a lot of dialogue amongst members of the group, an atmosphere that is extremely accommodating and generous in terms of just encouraging everybody to participate musically and spiritually. There's not the sense that there's a choir of professional singers and that's different from everybody else. Everybody is supposed to make music in this situation. This is a very special part of how he's trained, literally. I mean, you know, we don't usually think of this as a kind of training, but to be exposed to this on a weekly basis and to have your first musical experiences take place in this kind of situation, it's very powerful. And it's very much a part of who Louis Armstrong becomes as a musician, an adult musician, and as an entertainer, as a public figure. It has a lot to do with, I think, this training in church. So church is certainly a big part of his musical experiences. Blues is another big part. Blues, especially blues in New Orleans style, which means by this time, the first decade of the 20th century, means blues on wind instruments. That was the New Orleans specialty, blues on wind instruments. Other places in the country, Mississippi, for example, blues specialty was on stringed instruments, usually. That was the traditional plantation instrument, the violin, the banjo, and guitar. In New Orleans, the specialty became blues on wind instruments, and Armstrong was surrounded by this. There's no doubt about it. And the sensitivity of the blues as a solo idiom for wind instruments shapes who he is as a musician. It shapes his sense of phrasing. It shapes his sense of expression. It's just very much what he is all about. So we actually have a reference from him in his writings where he talks about a street musician named Lorenzo who tutored him in a way. And he says he held me spellbound with his talk about music. And he had a musical soul. You know, this is a man who had no teeth and who existed by pulling around a cart around the city where he collected rags, bottles, and bones. They were called rags, bottles, and bones men, and many of them had tin horns that they played and played blues on. Literally, people describe how they were playing, and called children to them. Children would run when they heard this tin horn playing, sort of like the jingle of an ice cream truck, and bring their little discarded scraps of whatever it was, a bottle or some kind of used piece of clothing, and the the rags, bottles, and bone man would give them a little toy, a trinket, in exchange for this, and then he would sell it at the recycling place. Armstrong hung out with this guy and was literally tutored in blues by him. So these are the kind of references that are important to understand where it was he was coming from musically. It's a very different musical experience than what a Creole of color child would have on the other side of town, sitting and learning his instrument in a very traditional European way.
Yeah, one of the a number of the points that you make in the chapter called The Saints, and this is about the sanctified church, and I'll telescope this here for us this afternoon. The music in the church was a means for shedding all emotional inhibitions, you say, and it was also a social glue, and it was also a form of protest in a way. And then outside in the street, there's a mirror image. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that is a good summary, yeah. The idea of music being a form of social protest is something that's you have to sort of tease out from these accounts. And by the way, I might say that most of my sources for working with this book are oral histories, interviews that were made with musicians and participants from the period many decades after the fact. And it's difficult to work with that material. I mean, it's obviously problems with memory and so forth. But, you know, you do what you can. And we have a lot of these oral histories at archives in New Orleans. And so it's a lot of material to work with, actually. And you can sort of get a feeling for the way this kind of thing worked. The reason I say the musical practice in church, the kind of musical practice I was just describing, is this form of social protest is because there was a lot of pressure to abandon that kind of music, abandon that kind of religious practice in favor of a more traditional European style of worship. Mahalia Jackson, for example, who grew up in, not far from New Orleans, or not far from where Armstrong lived, a mile or so upriver, up the Mississippi River. She talks about that in her church. She said, our church was stiffer. It was more staid. We had bought into assimilation, essentially. And we had a choir, you know, who sang very formally, and we sat very neatly in our pew, and we clapped our hands a little bit. We didn't move too much, and so forth. So there was a lot of pressure to be that way in the United States at that time. And so to hold on to these old traditions which had come from slavery, everybody knew they came from slavery, and that was part of the problem for some people is they wanted to just eliminate all memories of slavery. So to hold on to them and to cultivate them was, in a sense, a form of protest. And to put them on the streets, as you say, which is what is happening in the parades. A lot of people talk about the so-called second line. That's the group of people who follow the parade. And they say that they essentially brought this church tradition, the sanctified church, the holiness church, out into the streets. And so there's something going on with the way the music is being played in the band that's like what's going on in the church. And there's something going on among the second line that's like what's going on in the shout tradition inside the church.
And what's going on at night inside the honky-tonks?
Blues. Blues, constantly. And Armstrong, when he's a kid, did not always stay home at night and had what we would call a juvenile delinquent childhood, no doubt about it. Part of that was sneaking off and hanging out in these honky-tonks and listening to blues. Honky-tonks were little gambling places. A place where Armstrong lived was surrounded by these honky-tonks, and blues were played all night long. And by the time he's 14 years old, he's got a job playing his cornet in one of these places late into the night and playing blues, and only blues, because that's all he knew how to play, basically.
Mm-hmm. When did he first pick up a horn?
Well, there are different stories about that. The story that I accept, because he told it that way so many times until the end of his life, actually, then it started to change. I think his memory faded a little bit. I think probably it's when he goes into the Colored Waifs home for boys. He's arrested at age 12 and put in this, he calls it an orphanage. Sometimes he calls it a delinquent home. And he spends a year and a half there. And it's a very important part of his musical training, actually, because he gets brought into the brass band that the home has and eventually works his way up to playing cornet and is the lead cornetist for the band and gets lessons on a weekly basis with the musical director of the home. And it's very important for his musical development.
Yeah, that was a turning point in his life. And if I'm remembering the name correctly, a fellow by the name of Peter Davis was instrumental here.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. And Armstrong becomes friends with him. He's sort of a mentor to Armstrong. So it's very important in a lot of ways. He actually learns to read and write in the home, too.
Yeah, and it was Davis who said, you know, it is important also to learn to know the music, the notes, the read.
That's
yes.
correct, yeah. He says, don't be just a ragtime player, be also a classical player. It's interesting, those terms, they have very specific meanings during this period for these group of people. Ragtime means what we call jazz. Armstrong did not use the word jazz. He and his group of people did not know that word, actually, as a word for their music, which is interesting because we think of this as the birth of jazz, and we think of Armstrong as the greatest jazz player ever. But he didn't consider himself a jazz player at that time, nor did he in the early 1920s, by the way. Yes, and classical meant notated music. So that's the dichotomy that Jones is referring to. Classical and ragtime means notated music and non-notated music.
Yeah. So how did he synthesize, then, ragtime and classical?
Ah, synthesize. I'm not sure if I would say he synthesized them. He certainly was not... He was enthusiastic about learning from whoever he could learn from. And so... when he saw classical musicians, what he would call classical musicians, you know, the creoles of color and so forth, he wanted to learn how they were doing things. There were a lot of reasons to do that. One was that it opened up a much bigger spectrum of jobs. And the other was, as he acknowledged, it would improve his improvisational skills, the more expertise he had on his horn and the more knowledge he had of music. And so in a way, he does fold that learning into his improvisation and into his jazz.
Thomas Brothers is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a professor of music at Duke University, and he's the author of Louis Armstrong's New Orleans. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments. You can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. At the age of 15, King Oliver, Joe Oliver, took him under his wing. How did that happen?
Well, I think Armstrong pestered him enough, actually, that he finally just gave in and also acknowledged. I mean, everybody could see that there was some talent there, that Armstrong had some ability, musical ability. And Armstrong had attached himself to Oliver in parades, as I mentioned earlier. Oliver was his main idol and the main person he liked to carry the horn for when he marched around town. And then around age 13 or 14, he's also finds a way to get into Storyville, the district of legalized prostitution, where Oliver has a job and he finds out a way to hang out and hear Oliver playing. So there's no doubt that Oliver is his idol and his role model as a musician. And, yeah, Armstrong's very fortunate that Oliver decided he would mentor him around age 15. He has him over to his home, and he shows him more things about the cornet. He shows him how he does things. And and Oliver has a very similar background to Armstrong. He comes from, as I mentioned, the plantations. His family came from a former slave plantation some 50 miles from New Orleans. And he's a musician who grew up in church and grew up being an expert in the blues and then gradually tries to find his way into the professional musical circles that demand a bigger range than that. So Oliver knew exactly what Armstrong was up against. Also, they both had very dark skin, which is an important part of the social texture of this period. People with dark skin suffered more prejudices than other African Americans. There's no doubt about that. So I think that's part of what's going on in this mentoring relationship. And Armstrong was very clear throughout his life that without Oliver, he wouldn't have amounted to anything. Oliver was his main mentor, his main role model, his main inspiration.
Hmm. Let's take a call. Listeners waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a very simple question. As you talk about relationship, can you say more? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer about relationship. No. I have not read the book, nor have I.
In terms of relationship, what relationship are you talking about?
Yeah, you're talking about honky tonk and social process and church, being emotional and all that stuff. So what kind of relationships are we concentrating on?
Maybe the caller is thinking about what kind of patrons were at these places where the music was going on. At the dance halls, we're talking about working class African Americans. The people Armstrong and his music, and the people he plays with are playing for are working class African Americans. They are day laborers. Men work on day laboring, unskilled laboring jobs, and the women work as domestics, that is, doing laundry and cooking for white people. If you weren't happy with either of those jobs, there weren't many options available to you. One option was prostitution, which his mother apparently was experienced in, and another was pimping, which Armstrong himself talks about doing himself. So that's an important part of what's going on here. Let's see, what other kinds of...
I wonder if the caller is thinking, the relationship between from church to parade to honky-tonk, how these three threads come together.
Yes. I did mention that they took the church out into the streets and the parade bands were sort of doing what was being done in church. The way I think about that is with a practice, and I'm going to get a little technical musically because it's the only way to really describe it in any meaningful way, is what is called heterophony. It's a texture of group music making. If we're all sitting in a room and we all sing Happy Birthday, we can do it in at least two different ways. We could sing Happy Birthday and try to be in exact unison, which is usually what we do in the society I live in, or we could all sing Happy Birthday with our own version of Happy Birthday and have that be done simultaneously, have our own individualized version. So if we're 20 people in a room, we have 20 different versions of Happy Birthday. That's heterophony, when we're all singing the same song with our own different version of it. And there's a certain it's a way for group participation to happen. And there's a certain delight in having this sort of individuality come out of everybody's different version. So, yeah, that has a lot to do with relationship, actually. It's a communal way of music making, and that's what I'm imagining is happening out in the streets in parade culture also. This is talked about a lot. You have to have the melody carried by one main instrument, and that's usually the cornet, or it can be the clarinet also. And then the other instruments embellish the melody with their own versions of it, the other melody instruments, the trombone, the clarinet, the violin, and so forth.
Let's take I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, sure. That's it.
Okay, we can take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi. We have a caller there on line two? I guess not. Maybe they will call back. Don't know what happened there. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Before we run out of time, I thought it would be interesting to play something from the 20s from Louis Armstrong. And we have Hotter Than That. And maybe it would be useful if you would tell us something about what we're about to hear and where Armstrong is at the moment as a musician. This was recorded in Chicago in 1927, I believe.
Yes. Yeah, this is a famous piece from 1927 with his Hot Five. I should say that the period I'm working with, he leaves New Orleans in 1922, and mm-hmm. that's where my book stops. There is no recordings of music in New Orleans from that period, so it's an amazing lack of evidence. We have to sort of piece together from descriptions what things sounded like, and also from the later recordings. This music starts to get recorded in Chicago in 1921 when people leave New Orleans. So this is, as I say, Armstrong left New Orleans in 1922 for Chicago and then spends the next 6 or 7 years there with a year in between in New York. And that's where he really becomes famous as a jazz soloist. And this is one of his most famous and spectacular pieces. This shows him a fully developed virtuoso, a virtuoso trumpet player and a virtuoso improviser, also a virtuoso singer. There's a wonderful scat vocal in this that will be really fun to hear. Also a sense of, I was talking about the musical dialogue of church. You'll hear some musical dialogue in this piece. It's a very lovely part of the texture. But also just the imagination of it, the range of creativity is just very stunning, and the excitement of it. So hotter than that, as if to say, I bet you can't play hotter than that. This is a very showy piece. This sort of shows him at the top of his game, really, and it's justly famous.
I love that.
That's a great piece.
Hotter than that.
Yeah.
We have the caller back from Champaign. Apparently,
okay.
she had to put the phone down and attend to something else. So, but she's back. So let's go to the listener on line one. Hi.
Hi. This program sounds so wonderful. I am so sorry that I have missed four-fifths of it. Celeste, I hope you, you know, sometime will reissue it as an archival piece. So this question may have been asked and answered before. I have listened a lot to the Jim Cullen Jazz Band, which is on WILL's on Friday. And one of the things that they talked about was that Oliver wrote letters to friends saying that he had, you know, he was doing manual labor. You know, he wasn't a musician anymore, and that the people who he had given a hand up to, you know, were not helping him, and. So I knew that there had been a close relationship and a teacher-mentor relationship with Louis Armstrong, and I just wondered what was the demise of King Oliver's career, and did he die in desperate straits, and what happened was there a break, a split between him and Armstrong, where Armstrong you know, just wasn't helping him out of a bad time, or, you know, was it alcohol and drugs that did King Oliver in? I know that was a real hazard of the profession. So I would love to hear about things like that.
That's a great question. Thank you. No, it wasn't drugs. In fact, Oliver shunned alcohol, and Armstrong, as his student, was not too crazy about alcohol either. The biggest problem was poor health and also the depression and also just the changing fads of the music industry. You know, popular music industry in the United States is a cruel, cruel system where people go out of fashion very quickly and then it's over. You know, when you think about Armstrong, whose career lasted until the very end, you know, until 70 years old, that's extraordinary, you know, that someone could keep going through so many different changes of fashion and so forth. So, I mean, it wasn't unusual. In fact, by the time the 20s are out, all the people Armstrong grew up with are struggling, and a lot of them don't make it through the Depression and into the swing era. Armstrong does, and you could say it's because he's better than everybody else, but he's also eventually, and then after the 30s, he keeps going because he's really very well managed. Also, he's extremely adaptable, very, very nimble-minded in an improvisational sense and very responsive to changing situations. As for the personal relationship of Armstrong and Oliver, Oliver did die in a very sad situation in poverty in Savannah, Georgia in 1938, I believe. And Armstrong did see him in Savannah, Georgia on tour not too long before that. I'm not sure the exact date. It's maybe around 36 or something like that. He was touring in Savannah with his band, and there was Oliver after the show at the stage door. And according to Armstrong, he did give him some money. I don't know, you know, how much he gave him, whether he could have done more for him. I'm not sure. They hadn't been in touch much for a few years. You know, the earlier history of their relationship, sort of after Armstrong comes to Chicago and plays in Oliver's band in 1922, 1923, and 1924, and then he leaves Oliver's band. Oliver had been sort of trying to hold him back. It's an interesting moment for the two of them. Oliver needed Armstrong because his gums were failing. He had gum disease, pyorrhea of the gums, and his teeth were loose, and it was very difficult for him to play the way he used to play. So he needed somebody like Armstrong, and he always continued to have a good, young, strong second trumpeter in his band. So it's an interesting relationship at that point. Armstrong does break free from Oliver and, you know, steps out into the soloist spotlight on his own and so forth, and the rest is history, as I say.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. Another listener called in and wanted you to talk about Charles Buddy Bolden and Armstrong's relationship with him.
Well, I actually have a chapter on Bolden in my book. I try to do the best I can with the Bolden legends. It's very difficult. There are some good material on research on Bolden, but there's a lot of mythology and legends. It's a very hard thing to sort through. Bolden, Armstrong said that he saw Bolden play when Armstrong himself was 5 years old. And it was just a year after that where Bolden went insane and then was committed to an insane asylum and lived there for the next 20-some years of his life. So Bolden was off the scene by the time Armstrong really gets going as a musician. But Bolden is the first famous cornet player who in New Orleans from the black community. And he makes his reputation by playing blues. He may have been the first cornet player to be a blues specialist. Certainly he was the most famous one to be a blues specialist. So a lot of people think that he is the central figure in the formation of jazz in that way.
Hmm. We have to wrap up here, and we only have a minute left. In the end, when it boiled this whole huge, wonderful story down, what would you like listeners to come away with, readers to come away with, people who pick up this book?
Well, I think the main thing is, where did this music come from and where did Armstrong come from? It came from poor black people in New Orleans, people who had come from the plantations, as I said at the beginning, who had come from the former slave plantations in escape of terror and violence and poverty to the city in the late decades of the 19th century. Those are the people who gave rise to this music. And I do want to put in a plug for New Orleans, Celeste, before we go. The Jazz and Heritage Festival is coming up this weekend. I'm not from New Orleans, as you know. I live in Durham, North Carolina. But I'm very fond of New Orleans, and I want to assure people that there's a lot of great things going on in New Orleans. The Jazz and Heritage Festival is this weekend and then the next weekend. And then they also have the Satchmo Fest, which is a celebration of Armstrong's birthday in August. And they have a lot of great musical things. It's not just Mardi Gras. There's a lot going on in New Orleans. So it needs all the help it can get right now.
Yeah, sure does. Thomas Brothers, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
My pleasure as well. Thomas Brothers is the author of Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, the book now available in paperback from W.W. Norton. And our thanks this afternoon to Cabell Smith and the folks at the Duke University News Bureau for our ISDN connection this afternoon.